I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. My guest today is John Waters. Over a career spanning more than four decades, the Baltimore-based filmmaker, writer, actor, and spoken word artist has also created a significant body of visual art. This weekend, a major retrospective of John Waters' visual and audio work, photography, sculptures, and sound installations, opens at the Baltimore Museum of Art. It's called Indecent Exposure. In this terrific exhibit, fans of Waters' films will recognize the sophisticated, satirical, and hilarious perspective that he brought to Hairspray, Pink Flamingos, and so many of his other films. John Waters joins me when Midday starts right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. My guest for the hour is John Waters. He's a filmmaker, an actor, and a writer, not necessarily in that order. Early in his career, Waters established himself as an enfant terrible, who was affectionately dubbed the King of Sleaze. His filmography spans 40 years and 16 films, some of which are cult classics, while others, like Hairspray, are revered as popular icons. John Waters is also the author of many articles in art journals, as well as eight books, including Role Models, a collection of essays about people who have shaped his life in important ways, Carsick, his journal of a hitchhiking trip from Baltimore to San Francisco, and Make Trouble, adopted from a speech he delivered at the Rhode Island School of Design last year. What is certainly known in the contemporary art world, but perhaps less well known by the general public, is that John Waters is also a prolific and insightful visual artist. On Sunday, the Baltimore Museum of Art will open a major retrospective of John's work in a show that includes 160 examples of art that show Waters to be a trenchant observer and an analyst of popular culture. The show is called John Waters, Indecent Exposure. We will take your calls and comments a little later in the show. You are welcome to join us on Facebook. We are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page. Good to see you, John. Welcome back.
It's nice to be back.
So just for a second, we want to talk about this incredible exhibition. And the show is terrific, by
Thank
the way.
You.
I saw it the
Thank
other
you.
Day, the press preview, and it's just wonderful. This vote that just happened today, which is moving the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to a full vote in the Senate, either tomorrow or Sunday, that's unclear. What's your take on this in terms of the way, you know, the intersection of sex and assault and politics just gets roiled up in this big, huge stew?
Well, I was against him before any of the allegations, to be honest, and I'm still mad that we didn't get to pick him when Obama was at the very end of his run. So that's what I'm angry about.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's going to win. He's going to win.
Yeah, he's going to
win. And he's also going to be incredibly... How can he say he's not going to take it back out on the Democrats? He was bad. He was really angry, which if I was innocent and was accused of that and believed it, I'd be angry too. But you can't be when you're the Supreme Court. You can't take it out on one political party, which he did, which is, I think, is just another reason that he shouldn't be there.
A whole lot of people, you know, Amy Schumer, an actress whose name is escaping me, who was in one of her movies just the other day, arrested at the Capitol.
Right.
There are all sorts of celebrities who, you know, weigh in on these things. You get asked to weigh in on these things all the time. You do Bill Maher's show all the time. You know, you are constantly. What do you think the capacity of people in popular culture who have big platforms, who are very well known internationally, like yourself, what is the capacity and the responsibility of those people?
Well, if they want to do it, I got arrested a lot when I was young. That's enough in riots. You know, I have nostalgia for riots, if you want to know the truth. But at the same time, I think they have the right to. The same way today, if it's even worse, if you're a celebrity for Trump, if you even say it, your career's over. So basically, it is a touchy time. We're in a civil war, plain and simple. That's what's going on right now.
Yeah.
So I think that it's fine to go and use whatever power you have in any field to be political. I used humor. That's what I use. I mean, when I do my spoken word show, half of it is anti-Trump, but I'm trying to make you laugh about it. And in each show, I say, there must be somebody from Trump here. I'm in the South. I'm somewhere. Come up and say something just as awful as I just said about us and try to make us laugh. And no one ever does. Not one ever.
But the emphasis is try to make us laugh.
Make us laugh, because I'm not a separatist. I do believe that the only way we can change each other's opinion is to make us laugh first. And we still have to talk. If nobody talks, nothing's going to change.
The show at the BMA is terrific. And one of the things that struck me was each card next to each piece says John Waters, born 1946.
Yeah, I am 72, right?
72.
Yeah.
And it struck me, I just read last month Ann Tyler's latest
novel. Which I loved.
Yes,
yeah.
Clock Dance, yeah. Right? I loved it too. I just thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Ann is a couple years older than you.
She's we're friends.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And what is different for you? I think Anne is at the height of her powers. I think glorious novel. And what she's writing at age 75 is perhaps different. I don't know if it's better, worse.
Completely different.
But no, different than you. But what's it like being an artist working in your 70s? You know, coming from the tradition of and the way you bounced onto the scene as the enfant terrible when you were a very young,
well,
much
you
younger
mean,
man.
What's it like to be a filth elder? My new book is about Mr. Know-It-All, which comes out next year, is my opinion on everything. But it's basically, what do you do with respectability when you never wanted it and you get it when you're in your 70s?
You're winning all these awards.
Great things. I got named the Writers Guild Honorary Award. I got a medal from the French government.
From the French government. Yeah. Right.
So to me, that's great. Usually you hear that stuff at your funeral. So I'm getting to hear it when I'm alive. I'm busier than I've ever been in my entire life. I have more jobs than I've ever had in my entire life, even though I don't make movies anymore, even though they still pay me to write them and they just don't make them.
Do you, are you making work at the same frenetic pace that you always have done? You're one of the most disciplined artists I've ever known. I mean, you just put your nose to the grindstone all the time. Is it easier? Is it more facile now because you've been at it for so long?
Well, I like my work. I'm not sitting there struggling with an empty pad every day. Every morning I think up something. That's what I do Monday to Friday. In the afternoon I run my business. So I just finished this book. Yesterday I wrote the speeches I had to give last night at the opening at the BMA. I'm writing my 10 best lists for Art Forum next week. And then I'm almost finished the updates for the Christmas show. And then I go on tour. And then after that,
17 dates, right?
17
all
dates
over the place.
Yeah.
So I mean, no rest for the weary, to be
no,
sure.
No, retiring, I'd probably drop dead if I ever did, you know. So I am busier than I've ever been, which is good. And the traveling bit, Elton John said to me once, the day you stop touring, it's over. It's true. You can't blink.
He's about to stop touring.
After 300 dates for his farewell tour of the next 4 years.
And I'll believe it when I see it, too. It's like Billy Joel supposedly stopped touring, too. Now he's playing MSG.
I enjoy my work. So why would I want to stop, really?
And Baltimore, the centrality of Baltimore to your work, reminds me, my other life, I was a classical musician, and Franz Josef Haydn in the 18th century was sort of sequestered by his boss, this aristocrat named Esterhazy, in this palace in the middle of the woods in the middle of nowhere. And he said, so he wasn't in Vienna, he wasn't in, the cities where things were happening. He said, I had to be original. I had no choice because there was nobody to copy. There was nobody. So I wonder, the fact that you've never been a creature of Hollywood, or you have a home in New York, I think, and a home in San Francisco, but you don't live there. You really live here.
I really do live here. More than ever, I like it the best because it's still the only city left that's cheap enough to have a bohemia. And all the young people I know, most of the people that are having great success from Baltimore now are in the music world. They all are buying houses here. They're staying, which is what everybody should do all around the country. You don't have to go to New York anymore. To be honest, in New York, there's no new revolutionary youth movement. It's too expensive. You have to move to Brooklyn. That's too expensive. You have to move to Queens, which looks exactly like Highlandtown. Why do you want to move to New York to live in Highlandtown? Just live in Highlandtown here. It's cheaper.
Just start here. Right? Yeah. It is cheaper. I mean, it's really hard to be a starving artist anywhere, but it's really expensive to be
a
starving artist.
And you don't have to be kids don't want to be a starving artist anymore. They want to be a rich artist, which is another alarming trait. But I always say, if you ever say, I'm having more fun than young people in this day, or that means you're an old fart. You're not. They're having fun being hackers. They're having fun closing down the government on their computers. They're having just as much fun as I did causing trouble.
You've said a number of times, including just now, that this is sort of the only place where you can have a bohemia anymore. Well, why is that? I mean, is it just because of the economics of it?
Yes, it's still cheaper here than anywhere else. It's also easy to get to New York. The Bolt bus isn't bad, except that the driver stops and relieves himself in the bathroom, which I find appalling.
On the other hand, you don't want him driving if he's...
Well, I do. I think plan ahead. I don't think elimination should be a bus driver's prerogative.
All right, duly noted. I'm on the Bolt bus tomorrow.
All right, well, just when they pull over and the New Jersey Turnpike and the bus is in stunned silence while he's in the bathroom for 20 minutes, I'd bolt right off the bus.
By the way, Mr. Waters objects.
Yes. Please do.
But is because we've all talked for years, you know, I've lived here now 36 years, we've all talked about how unique Baltimore is and how, you know, funky and eclectic, and it's this sort of sui generis place. Is it really?
Sure. Come on down. We got edge.
Well, we got edge, but I mean, does that mean like, you know,
we got bad edge
Phoenix
too,
and Detroit and Atlanta and Cleveland and Pittsburgh don't have edge?
It's a terrible thing that we're once again with the murder capital, but I always thought, who wants to be second? Really, and
winning is everything.
Travel and Leisure picked us as the ugliest people in America. And I thought, well, who wants to be second ugliest? That somehow is worse to me.
That's right. Vice president of ugliness is terrible.
Yeah.
You want to be the president of ugliness. Are there people from outside Baltimore, because you travel all over the world, that have a sense that Baltimore is as cool and funky and eclectic as it is? Or do they have the sense of, you know, David Simon's The Wire or, you know, that kind of stuff?
They do see that. And unfortunately, whenever they're going to Washington and they come on the train, they go through what the worst picture of Baltimore they see. But, you know, that is what Baltimore is like, too. The problem is nobody leaves their own neighborhood. That's the whole problem with Baltimore. That's where I think we have all the troubles. And I always said that once a year, like jury duty, you should have to switch economic neighborhoods, live in that neighborhood for a week, get your hair done there, send your kid to school there, and go to the local bar for 2 weeks, live there, and then move back to where you're really from. And everybody would get along better.
That's an actually really good idea. My idea is to have everybody in the Maryland General Assembly have to take the bus for a week.
Yeah, see, I take the bus all the time in San Francisco, but here sometimes you take the bus and you see people with their face pressed up the window going, "Help me!" You know, so it doesn't...
It's a little intimidating.
I must admit, I don't take the bus here, and I do use public transportation, and I love that one kind of rebel that put out all these signs everywhere that how late the bus was and tracked them and put up pictures and everything and really shamed the bus company to show how completely untruthful they were about their routes. But I feel sorry for bus drivers because, you know, it's a tough job. Yeah. Especially when school lets out.
Yeah. Especially when you're on the Jersey Turnpike and
I'm talking about the local bus drivers. Okay. Yeah.
Of course, you know, when people talk about Baltimore, they talk about you first and then, you know, David Simon.
Me first.
Well, they do. You know, Johnny Unitas and John Waters. And I mean, you're part of the sort of cliche, if almost, about what Baltimore is about.
I wish Madeline Murray was still with us.
That's right. A big hero of yours. You wrote about her.
And Ann Tyler, they still do talk about, too.
Well, they should. But you also have a very long relationship with the Baltimore Museum of Art. I mean, going back to the 80s.
Going back to my childhood, because that's when I first took home a little Miro print and hung it on my bedroom wall in Lutherville, Maryland. And the other little kids looked at it and went, "That's disgusting. Why would that's ugly?" And then I realized that art could infuriate people. So I became a collector. That's how I started collecting art when I was 8 years old. So to go back there, and Brenda Richardson, who was there for a long time, was my art mentor. She taught me everything. So to go back home there and to have this show is really like going home. And we have a new director, and I'm for the new mission, everything that
This is Chris Bedford.
Yeah, Chris Bedford, the way he is imagining the Baltimore Museum to go forward now, I agree with.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and we will come back forthwith. John Waters, a huge retrospective of his visual art, opens at the BMA this Sunday. It runs through January 6th. After a quick break, we'll have more with John Waters at 410-662-8780. If you want to join our conversation, you can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org. You can send us a tweet, @midday WIPR. You can follow me on Twitter, @TomHall WIPR. You can also catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on our program, the activist and author DeRay McKesson joins me to talk about his new book. It's called On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. So DeRay McKesson will be right here in Studio A coming up Monday on Midday. If you're just joining us today, John Watts.
I like DeRay. I supported him for mayor.
Yeah, he ran for mayor, and you were quite a vocal supporter, and that's good for him. If you are just joining us today, that's John Waters. He's with me here in Studio A. He is a lifelong resident of Baltimore and the Baltimore burbs. His movies were shot here. His spoken word material, his books, and his many articles were written here. And now, for the first time, his visual art is featured in a major retrospective here at the Baltimore Museum of Art. The exhibition is called Indecent Exposure, and it opens on Sunday. If you'd like to join us, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR, and we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. By the way, Pam, John, gets in touch and says, yes, every member of the General Assembly should take the bus at least once.
So, all right, so, I agree. Did they get a transfer?
Yeah, I'll pay. I will personally pay for the transfer.
Do they still have transfers?
I think they do. Yeah,
I think they do. In San Francisco, you get to use it both ways. Here, you only one way.
Right. I was just out there a couple of months ago, and I was amazed. I didn't have to buy a return ticket. Oh. Yeah, it was great. I mean, obviously, so many folks know you as a filmmaker, and you started your career as a filmmaker. You said the other day in the press preview that there's no such thing as a bad movie, that there's always something on the screen that can delight you. How do you watch a movie? How do you explain
to someone?
Well, it depends.
If you're watching a movie and you're trapped and you can't walk out and you hate it, then forget the plot and the actors. Just look at the ashtrays in it, or look at the art on the wall that you're never supposed to notice. It just fills up a set. Look at the detail that you're never supposed to concentrate on, and then you'll have a whole new narrative. The whole new movie will be completely different. And the same way, there's 24 frames a second. So if a movie's 90 minutes long, think how many frames that is. One of them is good.
It's got to be. Yeah. The law of averages says. Now, how about visual art? A static image on the wall. When folks go to your exhibition, I once talked to Gary Vicon about this. I mean, how do you look at a painting? And he says, I get really close to it. You know, I put my eye, you know, an inch away from the thing. Of course, if you do that now at the BMA, you'll get thrown out.
But no, mine squirts you with water.
Yeah, that's right. There is one that
I have one that's a parody on the insurance regulations of masterpieces. So it has the little warning tape that usually if you step in front, it goes zzz. This one, it squirts you in the face, which is, I love seeing it. It's like candid camera.
But do you look at static visual art in the same way you look at a film, or is it?
No, you watch a movie and you see art, kind of. To me, what I look at, my work is like storyboards, awfully. You read them right to left. I think them up before I do it. Then I have to go find images in other people's movies, isolate them, put them in a new narrative, and put them in a whole different story that I'm telling, not the original director's. So yes, that one thing is hung on the wall, but you look at it forever. That's beyond the cult movie that I've seen Rocky Horror 8 times. If you own an art piece, you see it 800 times every day, so much so that it becomes part of you. And it is your roommate, and it's who you live with, and that becomes very, very different than a movie.
Do you watch your own movies?
No.
I mean, you've seen Rocky Horror 8 times?
But
other than when you edit.
The last thing I would think, now, sometimes I have to when I go, we just had a beautiful, the Academy of Arts and Science gave us a 30-year anniversary showing in Hollywood of Hairspray with the cast and everything. I watched it then. You know, if I'm appearing at a film festival where I'm getting a tribute or something, I sort of have to watch them. But that's fine. That's
what
different.
Do you think?
I like watching them in other countries with subtitles. Or even though I hate dubbing, that's my favorite to see him dub because it's so bizarre to see Edith talking with, you know, an Italian voice.
Yeah. Right. You have often said you are first and foremost a writer.
Yeah.
And so when you encounter a movie, I mean, obviously you start by writing your own movies.
Yeah, I've never directed a movie I didn't write.
Right. Yeah. So the other movies that you encounter, I mean, you always introduce a film every year at the Maryland Film Festival. Yeah. There's movies that none of us have ever heard of, ever, you know, but they all are delightful and very unique and
They aren't that delightful to some, but they're extreme.
Yeah. And they are just, you know, we wouldn't have thunk it ourselves, so we're glad to be there. But do you approach the first encounter with a movie from the point of view of the script? I mean, is the script the central thing to you as a writer, or do you do it any other way?
Well, the script's important, and I often do like writer-directors the best, their movies. Certainly Fassbinder and all the directors I like so much did write their own movies. But yes, the story's important, but I always love a feel-bad movie from a foreign country. That's my genre I like best.
It's a niche. It's kind of a niche. But you've found it. You've discovered it. And you've loved it. That's good. John Waters is my guest. There's a new exhibition of his work at the BMA that opens on Sunday. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. We are also streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. And John, Pam says, I'm hoping that there are references to female trouble at this exhibition.
Well, I don't do my own movies, except there is images from Female Trouble, but I take them out and put them with other images, so it really doesn't have anything to do with Female Trouble anymore. There's one I have called Doubles, and it's Divine in Female Trouble looking very much like Elizabeth Taylor, and the picture next to her is Elizabeth Taylor with her hair in rollers looking like she's getting ready to get dressed as Divine. So I just opposed different images together from different movies. I would never just have Female Trouble. You know, it would be, but certainly images from my even earlier movies work better in the art world. If they're badly filmed on movies, when I re-photograph them, they look artier.
Yeah, and you do really mine all sorts of movies for this exhibition.
Oh,
because
certainly,
there are photographs, like there's one of people's feet.
Well, that's Elizabeth Taylor's feet.
Yeah.
And I just want to tell you, do you know how hard it is to see any feet in a movie? Think of the shape of a movie screen. It cuts off the feet. So I had to look through 8 million to find just close-ups of Elizabeth Taylor's feet in movies. And there are a few, maybe one or two cultists in the whole world that can identify which movie they're from by looking at those feet shot that are only on the screen for about 2 seconds.
We have Michael on Facebook saying, what was John's favorite part of Camp John Waters this year?
Oh,
what
God.
Is Camp John Waters? I don't
Camp
know
John Waters is this yearly thing that is really insane. It's in Kent, Connecticut. It's a real summer camp. It's sold out both years. People come from all over the world for 4 days. They dress as characters in my movies. They meet and greet. They have real camping activities, like at the arts and crafts. They made hate bracelets. They have
this year, all at your wondrous direction.
Well, I mean, I'm hired to do. I have a promoter. This year we had an obscene phone call contest with Mink Stole because that was a scene in. But the thing that happened the most alarming this year was waiting in line, and the girl got to me for the meet and greet. She said, "Do you mind if I eat dog feces in front of you?" I said, "Wow!" And she had a little deli tray with a little piece in, and I turned my head, but she did, and she said that was her bucket list, and I said, "Well, knock yourself out."
Exactly. But of course, you're thinking. And like, I've been there, done that.
So. No, yeah, but I didn't think anybody was going to do it again.
Again.
There was no reason.
Once was enough for that.
The summer camp is great. Then they have a costume contest where people come as the most obscure things from my films. One girl was the flames that burned the trailer down in Pink Flamingos. It's truly amazing. They have it. People got married at it. There were people all over the world from Japan. It's an amazing weekend in a beautifully restored real summer camp.
A real summer camp. Yeah. Now, one of the movies that you do as an installation for an art show like this is Kitty Flamingos, right?
Yeah, I did that just for an art show. I don't think of that in my filmography because I got the point where Hollywood now makes gross out movies that cost $100 million and they aren't funny. So I thought, well, I better go backwards. So I just took all the dirty stuff out of Pink Flamingos and rewrote it for children and then had children read it.
Yeah, and you're sitting there at a table, like,
yeah,
literally
they're reading
it's a table
it in
read,
the costume. But,
right, right.
Yeah. And so that's at the museum show too, yes.
So Scott sends us an email and says, in the 90s, while I was a MICA student, a friend and I were standing upstairs at the Club Charles when John Waters walked up the stairs and was standing nearby. I said to my companion, "Hey, that's John Waters behind you." And my friend turned around and reached out his hand towards Mr. Waters and said, "Hey, Roger Waters, good to see you this day, my friend. I'm a huge fan." Mr. Waters smiled politely, shook my friend's hand, and then went about his business.
Well, that happens a lot, but my favorite is when people say, "You're John Waters." I'm like, "Yes, I know that." Or my favorite is another thing, and these are really well-meaning people, but I can be in an airport anywhere in the world, and people come up and say, "Oh, I just wanted to tell you, I'm from Baltimore." Like, Oh, thank God. I couldn't survive. I couldn't be here in Denver
without one other person from Baltimore.
But they mean really well, but it sort of does catch me off guard. Or people that say, look, I can see you. I'm not blind when you're saying that. Just say hi. You know, they go, look at it. An inch from me.
Sometimes I introduce myself to people and they say, oh, I know who you are, but they don't tell me their name. It's like, I'm trying to shake their hand and say, hi, I'm Tom, what's your name? Yeah. And it's like, oh, I know who you are. And they clam up. It's like, well, and you are? You know, I have to.
Or the worst is when someone asks you for your autograph and then somebody else says, who's he? That doesn't know. And then they say, can I have one? I said, well, why would you want my autograph if you don't even know who I am? So I just signed like Justin Bieber or something.
Justin Bieber is in this show.
Yes, he is, with a facelift. And I'm friends with Justin. I met Justin. He drew on my mustache. So I'm a pro Justin. I'm a believer.
A believer.
Yes.
But, you know, you do a lot in this show with irony and with juxtaposition and stuff.
All contemporary art uses irony. It's overload of irony.
Yeah. But when you think about Justin Bieber, you think about this very handsome young man and stuff, and then you've got him depicted in this sort of grotesquerie.
Well, in a facelift way. But let me tell you, people are getting facelifts younger and younger. 20-year-olds get facelifts now. And so that's why I even have Lassie with a facelift in it, because I'm not so sure there isn't facelifts for pets in L.A. now. There could be. And, you know, all actors, they don't. So Pee Wee Herman's the only person that's ever admitted this. It costs, adds about $1 million to your budget. They go through every frame and retouch it. On stars.
Wow.
Every frame. It costs at least $1 million. It adds to the budget.
Wow.
And Paul did that in his last movie, and he demanded it and got it, which I think is great. I want it in daily life.
I want
every selfie to have to do it.
Right. Someone takes the selfie and then comes and touches it up right there. And then you give them the phone back.
Yeah.
Kristen Heilman, the curator of contemporary art at the BMA, who's terrific and very gifted. She said the other day at the press preview that this was 4 years in the making.
Yeah, it takes that long because, A, and by the way, she did a great job. She totally got it. She made me look intellectual and trashy at the same time in a museum setting. And that's not an easy task to pull off. Right. It takes 4 years because, A, well, we built a big model to hang it. She decided which work she wanted to be in and the groupings, which I very much liked. And usually I'm a little nervous of that, but I think she got it. Then you have to find all the work that collectors have all over the world. You have to get them. You have to agree to for them to take it off their wall, ship it, do all this. It's quite complicated. And there's many rules about lighting and all the stuff that museums have. So it really did take 4 years. And it went smoothly, though. It did go smoothly.
Did you have veto power over, you know, if Kristen said, I want to put this one on this wall and that one on the other
wall? Well, I think we would have discussed it. It wasn't like I didn't have a contract that said I have final cut.
But does it, when you go into an exhibition, do you look at it like you look at a set in a movie?
I think the installation is a big part of all museum shows is how you do it. Yes, very much so. And we had to deal with also that there's one room of stuff that even today I can't imagine school children walking into it, but there's a sign, you know. And I think probably the stuff that said for mature viewers is the most immature artwork. I think kids would love it. Bad kids in high school would really want to go to the museum more.
Does this exhibition, because it is a retrospective, and I think you mentioned, I'm not sure if we were talking about this on the air or off the air, but that you had one in New York about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But of course, you've done a whole bunch of work in the
since
last 10 years.
And it was not all the same work either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 160 pieces, that's a lot. Does it sort of amount to a somewhat selective autobiography? I mean,
Kind of it is. I started doing this first in 1992, so however many years that's been. I have a show maybe every 4 years or so. And it's funny to see them all because once you have a show, you never see the work again. I don't have it hanging in my house. Someone buys it, or it goes to the warehouse of the art dealer that might sell it later or put it in a group show or everything. So you never see them again. So they were there last night. You know, they're all together. And I said in my sort of a speech last night when we had the big opening kind of dinner, I said, I think I can hear them talking to each other. Like the Mr. Ray one saying, we're in a museum. And I could hear the Cone collection groaning in mortification. Even the Blue Nude. I'm not going to be upstage. So I could hear them. I could hear them having their own little discussion, inanimate objects.
Kristen called you a generator and analyzer of pop culture. Is that the artist's role in general? Is that your role in particular? Is that, first of all, do you buy that description?
Well, it's very nice. I think contemporary art's job is to wreck what came before. pop art put abstract expressionism out of business in one night, just like the Beatles put Motown out of business in one night. The new art movements are always hated when they first come out. Matter of fact, if they're not hated, they don't become art movements.
What does popular mean today in 2018? Because popular, what's the best metric to measure popular? Is popular number of hits on a website or number of albums sold? Or
that is the way it's judged, certainly. But popular to me is what will still be around in 10. Will it be remembered in 5 years? Will it be remembered in 10 years? That is the kind of popularity that lasts. I mean, movies come out today in the summer that make $100 billion the first weekend, and I don't even know what they are. They don't even enter my consciousness. They're gone. I see the trailer. You see the whole movie. They show it to you anyway. So to me, they're popular. But to me, that's not my idea of popular. It's something that will last, that changes things, that people remember, that smart people remember, or really dumb people remember. That's just as strong. But it has to be remembered. If it's just used up that week, it's popular, but for a week, not for a month, not for a year.
And that distinction between the smart people and the dumb people, does it matter? I mean,
no, it doesn't matter.
Is the TMC National Enquirer audience, you know, who may buy millions of copies of or do millions of hits on their websites, we have this notion that that's one audience, and then the audience to the Baltimore Museum
is
a different one.
The thing is, the tabloids, the Enquirer, used to be good before the guy went for Trump and then became a snitch, and now they don't even do Trump anymore. But I have a headline in one of my shows that's kind of sobering. So it's Ed Sullivan raped me. And when that first came out on the Enquirer, I thought, oh, this is one of these ludicrous things they make
headline
up. That was
in
a
the
real
National
headline
in
the National Enquirer. But
it's
10
part
years
of this
ago,
exhibition.
10 years ago. And I thought, oh, that's the kind of thing where you, it's horrible. It is, you almost laugh because it was like so ridiculous. Well, now with Me Too, it probably was true. The woman that claimed it, I think it was probably one of the few articles that the National Enquirer printed that was completely true, certainly.
And of
but
course, you
I
have...
still get the National Enquirer in the mail.
Do you?
And
I you
get
subscribe.
The New York Review of Books. I have to. I have to read. I have to see what everybody's seeing.
Everybody. I mean, by
yes.
popular, because National Enquirer does have this huge subscription.
Not rate. Anymore.
Lord knows what it
way,
is.
Way,
is it way
less,
down.
Way less. Yeah, yeah.
But you're not abandoning them. Huh?
I wanted to this year because of politics, but no, I kept it.
You know, you make fun of the National Enquirer in a really funny way. Joan Didion, this great public intellectual, this wonderful writer, and if you've ever met Joan Didion, you know she's 90
sparrow-like,
you know, soaking wet. You have this bloated picture of her, and the headline is just Joan Didion,
weighs 300 pounds,
300 pounds or something. I mean, are we lionizing and celebrating the wrong people?
Well, what I'm doing is imagining if there was a National Enquirer about intellectuals, which I wish I was the editor of it. We're hiding outside to get a picture of Joan Didion in a bathing suit or you know, like only obscure novelists like Rachel Cusk's Secret Hidden Life, you know, stuff that really no one...
Be Rachel very, Cusk, Meat Eater.
Right. Or Susan Sontag never laughed once.
Yeah, right.
That kind of headline, which I think she didn't.
The visual art that you're creating, are you creating it for a so-called mass audience? Are you creating it for a national audience? Or is it for collectors?
I mean, no, it's not for collectors either. It's for the art world, and a lot of it is about the insider knowledge of the art world and show business, certainly. But I think you could come if you had never been to an art show and like some of it. I think some of it could appeal to you, definitely. And I think maybe then you'd start looking at art again.
Jackie on Facebook says, quote, look at the details that you're not supposed to notice. This is what you're talking about looking at the movies. Jackie says, I do this too when I'm not into the story of a movie. We should all do this with our government as well.
Well, I know a famous painter that said to me, do you really pay attention to all that Trump stuff? Why do you look at it? He said, I just wake up every day and do what I want. Why do you let it bother you? And I thought, I wish I could be like that. But in a way, I guess that's kind of selfish. But at the same time, yeah, I still wake up every day and do exactly what I want. So far.
Yeah. You can do them both. I mean, they're not mutually exclusive. I do know a lot of people who have, like, tuned out of the news.
Well, I'm weary. I miss Walter Cronkite. I don't watch just the shows that I agree with. That's why I like to read the Wall Street Journal's editorials. Like, the day after the Kavanaugh, he testified, the New York Times had a brilliantly written And apparently I read them both
as well. I know.
And the one in the Wall Street Journal, why he should be confirmed. And it was brilliantly written too. So I think you have to read, even more so, the people you don't agree with who are smart, so you know how to fight.
And if you're going to be in the mix of pop culture, you have your to work, know. You got to know both sides.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, we will see a few more sides when we come back from a break. John Waters, a retrospective of his visual art, opens at the BMA on Sunday. Baltimore is also one of the stops on his Christmas tour this season. You can catch a John Waters Christmas at the Baltimore Soundstage on December 19th. Quick break. You can join us when we come back if you'd like at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. We are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page as well. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back. Good afternoon, Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. If you've just joined us today, John Waters is my guest. This year marks the 30th anniversary of his hit movie Hairspray. Fun fact, this was the very first movie role for the actor Josh Charles, who was 16 when he was cast as one of the Corny Collins dancers. In the following year, Josh was cast in Dead Poets Society with Robin Williams, and he's gone on to many roles in film and television since. Hairspray went on to several iterations after the first film version, including a Broadway musical that won 8 Tony Awards and a hit film of that musical. On Sunday, a major retrospective of John Waters' visual art opens at the Baltimore Museum of Art. And while there have been other retrospectives, this is the first one to be mounted here in his hometown. It includes more than 160 photographs, sculptures, and sound and video work. It continues at the BMA through the 6th of January. We are continuing our conversation with John Waters until the top of the hour. If you'd like to join us, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. And we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So Tammy sends us an email, John, that says, "Oh my God." She says, "OMG," but yeah, I'm a very hip person, so I know what that means. Thank you so much for the interview with John Waters today. It's the antidote I needed for all this Kavanaugh BS. Is art supposed to be an antidote, or is it supposed to be a window into into the Kavanaugh BS and everything else?
I went to all my rounds in my galleries in Chelsea last week in New York, and I went to make 25 shows. And I always think whenever I see Trump in them right now, I realize it just dates it. It just dates it because art has to last. And so I don't know that it puts,
So 8 years from now, painting's going to look pretty silly.
Looking at Saturday Night Live, Friday night, 2 days after it happened when they parodied it, was brilliant. And that's more subversive than anything really that contemporary art could do, I think, right now.
Because you are a gifted artist, because you are a great observer, can you explain to me what the deal is with Kanye and the Perrier suit on Saturday
Night? No, I was watching that and I thought, this is the most failed video I've ever seen in my entire life. It looked like what was that show that came on in Baltimore? Talented kids with the, I forget. But anyway, it was the most amateurish thing I had ever seen in my life. And I thought, is this a parody? I couldn't understand what it was supposed to be.
I couldn't understand it either.
The Collegians. That's what it looked like. A TV show that you're too young to remember.
I am too young
that
to remember
that came on in Baltimore locally, where people just sat on folding chairs and the hosts looked like William Burroughs after he had OD'd, and children did human pretzel acts and bad ballet. Oh, it was the most brilliant show that ever came on Baltimore.
I would work with a child
pretzel
actor.
Oliver Hughes, that was the name of the host.
I would work with a child pretzel actor in a heartbeat. They say never work with kids and dogs. Not
right.
Me.
I'm a contortionist.
That's right.
They don't have them anymore.
Count me in. excuse me, we were talking about popularity. I want to play a little clip of a sound installation that you have, which is called Sound of a Hit.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing today? Can I get 3 tickets for tomorrow's 1 o'clock showing?
Okay, tomorrow the 20th. Tomorrow's 1 o'clock. How many tickets did you say?
3.
It's $24.
24?
Yes.
So that's part of this installation at this thing. And that's
It's called Sound of a Hit, and it was recorded inside the box office of the Senator Theater opening day of Harry Potter. So it's an hour of making money, the sound of making money.
So instead of the ching, 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 yeah, speaking so of Roger Waters and Pink Floyd.
Yeah, so I think it's good. It's like for anybody in business that tries to think, well, maybe something could work. It's the sound of success.
Well, it's sitting right on there on the wall, yeah. And you can just listen to it for as long as you'd like.
Well, an hour.
Yeah,
and then you have to start over.
Then you have to start over.
Then you can start saying the dialogue along with it.
You can memorize the lines. That's right. I'll take three. Yeah. What is good taste?
Well, good taste today is basically having the confidence to believe that something you think is beautiful, even if other people don't. Bad taste is flaunting your wealth, really. You know, only Swiss people know how to be rich.
Only Swiss. Yes. You're going to just narrow it down to that particular pool.
Yes. Okay. I will racially profile.
I see. But I mean, when you see some of the people in show business and comedy in particular, the Kathy Griffins of the world, you know, with the Trump head and everything, that was a big dent to her career for a little while, but she seems to have rebounded. Mm-hmm. Or even, you know, Samantha Bee was roundly criticized for using the C word to describe Ivanka Trump. Is it because it's in bad taste? Is that bad taste?
Well, I do. And then after it, I called Trump a feckless pea, you know, the other word to... So I play on whatever you can't do and turn it around. I'm always interested in that gray area. You know, what is offensive and what is funny? And it's tricky because I think weirdly I am politically correct. I know people say, oh, how could you say that? But weirdly, I think I am. So, yes.
You mean that's... personally or in your work or in your
both,
art or both?
Both. So what I'm saying.
And by politically correct, you're a considerate person.
I don't judge other people when I don't know the whole story. To me, that is politically correct. And so what I'm saying is that I think today it is even trickier than ever, comedy, the thin line of what you can get away with. But it's the most interesting thing, I think. What can you get away with?
We got a phone call from Shay in Baltimore. Shay, welcome to Midday with John Waters.
Hi, Mr. Waters. It's so nice to hear your voice.
Thank you.
I worked on the original Hairspray with your friend Chris Mason. We did hair and had a blast.
I miss Chris. She was great. Oh, yep.
I missed her terribly. So, but my question is, when we went to the premiere, you gave out cassettes of the original recording.
Right.
And I can't imagine how my cassette got lost over these years, but I'd love to get a copy of the original recordings. Are they available?
Well, the soundtrack to Hairspray is on CD, yes, certainly the original one. Now, I don't know if it's still in print, but you can get it on eBay. Yes, you can find the original thing. It's the same, the CD of the soundtrack was the same thing that was on that tape.
Oh, great.
So you can find it.
Even my daughter, who goes to Baltimore School for the Arts now, she just, oh, God, she loves the movie and... I want to give it to her for Christmas.
Well, good. I think you can find it. I think you can find it. But that's great. Thank you. And thanks for working on that movie. It was a lot of... Because people forget when they see that movie, that was their real hair. They weren't wearing wigs. Ricky Lake had to walk around looking with that hairdo like that every day when she went up to the Giant.
Yeah. For the shoot, that was three weeks or something?
Yeah.
Matthew on Facebook Live says, Lynchian has just been added to the Oxford English Dictionary, which
well,
I assume good. Refers to David Lynch. He says water-esque should also be in there.
Well, that's very sweet. David is, it's funny, usually whenever there's critiques of movies that say this is like John Waters, I usually hate that movie because they're trying too hard to be disgusting. I think David Lynch's last Twin Peaks, the TV show, was absolutely brilliant. So I'm a huge David Lynch fan. So I think he deserves his own word, definitely.
When it comes to this notion of taste, I mean, are there people who are sort of currently successfully monetizing the bad taste of, for example, Mr. Trump? I mean, people talk about his brutishness and his...
He doesn't think he has bad taste.
No, he doesn't.
Imagine you know, his gold-plated the artwork that he has stuff. Hanging in the White House. They don't even dare show it, I don't think. I don't even know.
I can't imagine. Yeah. I don't know what it is.
Although Jeff Koons' work would look unironically correct in there.
Well, whose work would look incorrect in there? I mean, I don't know. That's interesting.
Well, anyone... that used irony because he has none about himself. I guess he does. He makes fun of his hairdo. You know, his enemy is the wind.
It's true.
Or a convertible. You'll never see him in a convertible.
That's right. He won't have the Kennedy problem, that's for sure.
That's a double what you just said. I hope he doesn't have that problem.
We all hope, indeed, that he doesn't have that problem or anybody else have that problem. The Me Too movement and the comedians who have been, wrapped up in this in these scandals. I mean, we've got people who are just not working anymore. You've got actors, Kevin Spacey. We've got comedians. We've got show business executives, Les Moonves from CBS, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have to, you know, Weinstein, obviously. Is that going to affect people's... How will that affect the business of show business, which you know quite well?
Sure, I'm glad I'm not single these days. It's a tough time to ask people for a date. But at the same time, I know some of the people that this has happened to. And, I fight to get murderers out of jail. So I certainly can forgive somebody if they say they're sorry and try to start over. I can do that. I have to. I taught in prison. I believe criminals, no matter what kind, deserve a second chance. But you have to admit it. You have to say you were sorry. Now, the only one that Woody Allen said last week did shock me. And I have been in Woody Allen's movies. I know both sides. I don't know what to say about that one. You know, that one is a completely... But he said, when Sun Yi finally gave her interview and told her side of it, he said, you know, people think I raped my retarded daughter. That's what he said, which is a staggering statement. But he is right, because some of
the children...
He's right
that people thought that.
No, they're wrong. You know, first of all, he was never accused of rape. She wasn't his daughter. And they did have some children that had learning disabilities, but it wasn't her. So he put it in a really kind of shocking way. But he's right. Some people do believe that's what he is charged with, and he's not charged with anything.
Of course, that swirls around in this social media thing. You, are, by the way, completely absent from social media.
I work 10 hours a day. I have to save my material for my books, my TV shows, and my, you know, I don't give it away. And I'm not interested in what you had for lunch, really. I want to be harder to reach. It's not that I'm not on my computer. I'm on it all day long. And I'm not saying people send me the good stuff, all the hilarious stuff that's like, there was a picture of serial mom killing cat.
You're not missing out of anything.
No, I see a lot of the stuff. But I don't have, I work too long now to go and then, so that wouldn't be how I would relax, go in and.
You said the other day at the press preview at the BMA that you hate celebrity artists. And there are some people perhaps trying to cash in on their celebrity by producing stuff that, you know, isn't nearly as sophisticated as the stuff that you're
well
you're
I didn't
doing.
Say that I didn't say
no well that's what I'm saying yeah. But there's also this notion that everybody's an artist, you know, the so-called DIY movement, you know, do it yourself, and the deprofessionalization of art making.
Yes, certainly that you can paint means nothing anymore in the art world.
Yeah,
talent is not enough. You have to have a new idea. And so certainly I try to make fun of my celebrity in the art world. I had one self-portrait that's all my headshots, but they're like stamped, overexposed, or in the face scratched out and ruined in every kind of way. So I know that and try to make fun of that.
John Waters, a retrospective of his visual art, is at the BMA. It opens on Sunday. It's called John Waters' Indecent Exposure. Good to see you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on the show.
Thank you.
John and BMA curator Kristen Heilman will have a public conversation about the exhibition on the 1st of November. And on Friday night, November 9th, the BMA will screen 18 hours of John Waters movies. There will be prizes for folks who complete the entire Waters film marathon. That's what an exhibition should be. It should be about fabulous.
But you know what I wanted on the movie thing? I wanted to let them in free and make them pay to get out.
Pay to get out.
Yeah.
Well, you're negotiating that, I assume. All right, that's it for us today. Coming up Monday, Baltimore activist and author DeRay McKesson joins me here in Studio A. We're going to talk about his new book, The Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. We want to thank Bottoms Up Bagels for providing lunch today. Bottoms Up Bagels is a small batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, and specialty cream cheeses inspired by traditions of bagel making dating way back to the 1940s. Available at the Waverly and JFX Farmers Markets and online at bottomsupbagels.com. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. Rob Sivek, Sienna Greaves, and Kathleen Cahill produce our program. Jamila Kremple is WIPR's digital producer. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.